to join me and my guests as we try to develop conversations of consequence. It's Talk Radio where God matters, looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My new guest is an old friend and who's been on Church and Culture before, and I had him back because the conversation turned out to be so lively and unfinished. The pastor, John Berenson, is a retired Lutheran pastor, a graduate of St. Olaf College and Yale Divinity School and Emory University, where we met, was a pastor for many years in the Philadelphia area, and published a book entitled Cross-Shaped Leadership on the Rough and Tumble of Parish Practice. I imagine some of John's Catholic friends, Catholic priest friends, who were numerous, enjoyed reading that. He resides in Bucks County, north of Philadelphia, with his family, and tells me he enjoys cooking, baking, home improvement, and collecting classical music recording. Before I ask John to speak, I got a little surprise for him. Let's play that. John Berenson, do you recognize that song and who's singing?
Oh my gosh, this is like Drop the Needle in music appreciation class, isn't it? Back then, Drop the Needle, can you identify it? I'm tempted to say, because of the age of the sounding of the recording, that's what's got me puzzled and thinking maybe it is the St. Olaf Choir.
It is. It is the St. Olaf Choir where you went to school and sang in the choir.
Right, yes, but the age for the recording and the choral the vocal technique of the soprano makes it sound like it might be under the original conductor, F. Melius Chris Johnson.
It is a Christmas song called "The Christmas Symbol," composed by F. Melius Chris Johnson.
Right. And I wonder if it's not even one of his groups, although they didn't do a lot of recording. I have many.
This is conducted by Kenneth Jennings, who I suppose was the successor.
Yeah. See, at first there have only been four conductors, and now you're getting really emotional. You're trying to wedge your way in on me, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Well, F. Melius was the first, the St. Olaf Choir was the first college choral group to tour in the United States. It was like 1912, and that didn't go on. And also their band at that time. But then they performed in Europe, and they became kind of a sensation. And he conducted up into the early 50s, and then his son, Olaf Chris Johnson, took over. He was my conductor my first year in the choir, and then that was his final retirement year. We came east, we sang in Lincoln Center, et cetera. And then, after he retired, Jennings took over, who up until 20 years ago was a conductor, so that tells you how old I am, and he now, in fact, I exchanged an email with him recently, and he now resides in Minnesota, but then at this time of the year, he goes to Arizona like a lot of snowbirds. And then 20 years ago, Anton Armstrong, who's African American and from the East Coast. It's kind of a change up, but he had been at St. Olaf, is the current conductor. And they have their East Coast tour, in fact. This year they're going to be at Carnegie Hall, they're going to be at Princeton, they're going to be here locally. But, you know, it's funny you mentioned this, because as I was anticipating your call, if you don't mind my extending this, that first year in the St. Olaf Choir, which for me was 1968, which is, of course, a big year in the United States socially and historically, we were on this East Coast tour, and we sang one of our first concerts at a church called Luther Memorial, which is a big, big church in Madison, Wisconsin, in the university section. And we had, among other pieces, on the front part of the program, a Palestrina Ave Maria. And, of course, we all loved it because we like Renaissance music. And I'll never forget that just in that concert, since you're talking about the heart of Lutheranism, just before we sang that piece, which is about the third or fourth piece in, he turned around spontaneously and addressed the packed house, and he said, "You may be wondering why we're singing Ave Maria."
Yeah.
And then he was a very almost kind of a mystical fellow in a pious sense. And all he said was to the audience of 2000, he said, "Have you ever asked a friend to pray for you?" And then he just turned around and we sang it. We all were like stunned.
Whoa.
But he was that kind of guy who almost mystically would transcend different things. But yeah, that's very emotional, and I'm getting, very excited because they're coming east. And I'm going out to the Christmas concert this year.
Now tell everybody who's listening about a little bit about St. Olaf College.
Well, it's a Norwegian roots from the 1870s, 1860s, Norwegian immigrants. My grandfather, whom I never knew, they actually had a little seminary attached to them at one point. And my father tells me that my grandfather studied there. They were part of some of the ethnic Scandinavian groups that came. There were a lot of little splinter Lutheran groups.
So these are the kind of people that Garrison Keillor talks about, right?
Yes, this is exactly. In fact, every year Garrison Keillor does a show on campus, and he's very much in tune with all that. Yes, that is Lake Wobegon territory, and you either love it or hate it, but I love it.
Well, I've asked you to come back because we got at the end of our last show that we did together. And again, I want to tell everybody I'm talking to Pastor John Berenson from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. We got into some of the similarities and differences between Lutheranism and Catholicism and about some of your personal experiences in your interfacing with Catholics in the Philadelphia area and I think the seminaries as well. So I thought we might center our conversation more on Martin Luther himself. And I'll tell you what I've done to get ready for this. You probably know this, but back in the early part of the 20th century, in fact, about 1917, English-speaking Catholics published a book called The Catholic Encyclopedia, which is still widely used. It's online under newadvent.com. And it's very searchable, and for the time was an excellent work of scholarship. But I read the entire article devoted to Martin Luther because I wanted to get a look at what sort of the very traditional Catholic take on Martin Luther was. I mean, anyone who, like myself, has converted from a Protestant denomination to a Catholic has dealt with the figure of Martin Luther in terms of, theologically anyway, in terms of his justification by faith and sola scriptura, the basic principles that we are taught were part of Luther's break with the Catholic Church. And I wanted to just run by you some of the basic attitudes that I found in this and let you, as a Lutheran and a lifelong friend of many Catholics, including myself, sort of take these on and tell us whether you think these are fair, unfair, extreme, or whatever. And the first one I want to try on you,
go ahead. Like hard, by the way, it sounds like hardball.
Nah, not really. It's hardball and softball form.
Yeah, I'd rather have this be wiffle ball, if you don't
know. We used to do that, too. But one of the things that I find throughout this very long and scholarly treatment of Martin Luther are constant references to his father, to his upbringing, and to what the scholars of the Catholic Encyclopedia talk about an evident congenital inheritance of uncontrolled rage.
When you mention his father, what most of us Lutherans know about his childhood.
His name was Hans. Hans?
Right.
Yes.
You know, I don't know the thing about the rage. Wait a minute now. The things I do know are the following biographically. His parents were, in effect, of the merchant class. It says that they were, quote, miners, but he was really kind of a small business owner sort of person. So they were not, you know, they were kind of the emerging, you know, middle class out of the late Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, a merchant. Yes, he was known to be very, very strict. They expected and desired for Martin Luther. They knew they could see his intellectual gifts. They wanted him to be a lawyer more than anything else.
Right.
And in fact, that's what he began to study at university. And the famous story that we Lutherans tell and the biography reflects is that while he's studying law, there's this incident, this conversion incident in which he sees a particular prince. I forget there's an actual guy's name who was a prominent duke or prince in the area in that province, who just sort of gave it all up, gave all his wealth up and joined a monastery. And Luther was so impressed by this act of self-sacrifice. That was one of the early triggers to a lot of his questioning.
What about the thunderstorm, the lightning?
Yes, yes, yes. That was about the same time. In fact, that was at the same time. So now he's making this trip from wherever to wherever, and I should know it. But these places in eastern Germany, and there is a thunderstorm, and he is literally knocked off his horse, kind of like the incident in the Book of Acts with St. Paul.
St. Thomas Aquinas falling off his donkey, you know, on the way to Avignon.
I mean, I don't know. This seems to happen to a lot of these sort of these figures.
These intense religious figures.
Yeah, yeah.
They can't stay in the saddle.
Right, yes. And, well, we can talk about how many children Luther had, too, but I don't want to...
Five.
And his wife was an ex-nun, and by the way, she brewed her...
Oh, I'm getting to that. Don't worry about that. I got that on my list.
Yeah, he fell off, and he called out to St. Anne, like, because he was so frightened. He said, I'll become a monk if you just don't kill me, God. And that
right.
was one of those...
Actually, he evidently cried out to St. Anna.
Like, you mean from the Book of Luke or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
The traditional name of the mother of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Yeah, well, he, you know, it was one of those things like in trench warfare. God, if you let me live one more day, I promise I'll turn my life over to you. It was one of those classic experiences, and kind of like the same thing with St. Paul and falling off the horse on the way to Damascus and all that kind of thing. And he does indeed, and you're right, then he disappoints his family, you know, his father and them, by saying, look, I'm not going to be a lawyer anymore. I'm not going to study law. I'm going into the monastery. The rage part, I don't know enough about that biographically. I do.
Okay, well, let's sort of pass that by, and I'll go to the next thing, that this 1917 Catholic Encyclopedia has to say about Martin Luther, which is, by the way, mostly respectful. A little of it gets, I think, a little bit into the weeds, but they talk about his extreme views of his own sin. You know, his extremes to which he experienced guilt and experienced you know, he really thought of himself and human nature in general as pretty, how shall we say, fallen and incapable of doing much in the way of good works.
No, yes. I would say, in fact, the controlling question then became, as he entered the monastery and as he went about his studies, and his superiors recognized that he had these intellectual gifts, so they decided to send him back to the university, in this case to become a Bible scholar, because they needed teachers. So, okay, so now he's studying, but he's bringing this very intense autobiography, you know, with him, this intense self, highly intense self.
The theological term they applied to him was scrupulosity.
Yes, and in fact, I think he himself, but then what's very interesting with scrupulosity, yes, there was that, because no matter how many acts of penance he did, and he went to his confessor, by the way, his confessor was a very fine person who comes up good in both sides, Lutheran and Catholic history, as a very patient and wise person who tried to get him to, as we would say today, you know, don't jump off the bridge, bro.
Lighten up.
Yeah, like it was lighten up, Lucifer here, because, as he said, look, don't go scrounging around for your sins if you can't find any.
And, right.
But Luther felt that, yes, that's true. He knew that was true of himself. And the controlling question of his life at this point becomes, how can I get a gracious God? I don't know what it was in Germany, but a lot of Lutherans.
In other words, he felt distance from God because he was so aware of his own failings.
And he also then, the more he followed the advice of the church, and particularly the penitential traditions of the late Middle Ages, because he trusted them, you know, the specific acts of penance.
Yeah, we're talking about the 1500s, the 16th century,
right,
for those who are listening.
Yeah. The more he followed them, the worse he felt. The more he followed, the greater the distance of God. Instead of God being closer to him and reconciled, he felt even more, you know, God was the classic old man with the white beard who's going to send you to hell because you didn't eat your Cheerios.
Which, by the way, would sort of fit with the violent, overbearing father story.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of people take, you know, their image of their father and turn it into God.
It's the old, you know, the classic old thing in family life, wait till your father gets home.
Right, exactly. Well, evidently the mother did a pretty good job on him, too. But the school beat him up all the time.
He experienced that at a really cosmic and almost metaphysical level. But now you're combining this with a brilliant mind who could, as I might say to my children, you're overthinking this. So now your thinking is so intense. And now I think your mind is you know, biting back at you. But anyway, how can I get a gracious God? His superiors were very patient with him, more than later the papacy would be, because he wasn't a Augustinian, and he was part of the Brotherhood, and they made him into a scholar. And they,
I mean, he was an Augustinian monk teaching philosophy, studying theology and the Bible.
And he's the first one to translate the Bible from Hebrew to German, whereas the whole Middle Ages had been using the Septuagint, the Latin version. And he's the first one to go back to the original text, along with Erasmus of Rotterdam at the time, who was an enemy of his. But he translates the Old Testament into German vernacular from Hebrew, and that had never been done because he was, you know, he just wanted to get back to the sources. So what happens to him, he comes across this passage in the book of Habakkuk, the just shall live by faith. Later we'll get into the St. Paul thing about justification. But he comes across this, the just shall live by faith, and it hits him like a bombshell. He says at this point, he has this what they call this tower experience. And once again, we go with these classic, very intense experiences. He's been studying now. He's become a master of the Old Testament and the New Testament. He reads this passage from the Hebrew Scriptures, the just shall live by faith. And he says it wasn't as if the gates of paradise swung open and he walked through them, because he realized now that there was nothing he could do of any sort whatsoever, not even a little bit, to win God's favor. That God loved him even though he's a total mess. The total mess that I
this sort of sets up the next question I have for you, which the 1917 Catholic scholars actually treat with, I think, a great deal of balance, and they recognize that the decision to sell indulgences at a kind of fraudulent level, you know, where the Pope and the Archbishop were splitting the cash, and then you had the Dominican monk Tetzel running around, you know, sort of being the marketing guy.
But it was a fundraiser for St. Peter's in Rome.
Right.
Originally, it was part of a capital campaign.
Yeah, but it was, again, tied to people's, you know, spiritual life, their forgiveness.
Right.
Their,
you put it, they actually even had the guy Tetzel, the most notorious, even had a the traveling guy. He was a traveling
Tetzel.
He was the snake oil. Yeah, he was like the snake oil salesman of out in the Wild West, but here he is in Germany.
He was a snake oil gentleman who was extremely well educated, extremely articulate, and really took on Luther directly, who himself had incredible oratorical and dialectical and debating gifts, you know, the ability to take people on in public.
So,
and they went head-to-head both in writing and in their public speeches.
Yeah. Well, when he would come into town, there's the phrase that he would use that was part of a campaign speech, the typical the boilerplate speech that he made going from town to town, was something like this. When a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory doth spring, or something like that. And it was like a boilerplate saying.
Mm-hmm.
Was part.
You think he was kidding? You think that was kind of just a come on, and he sort of did it with a smile? I mean, could he have been that crass?
Luther, as someone who was also very pastoral and very much a counselor to people and not just a scholar, he would encounter, like, frankly, little old ladies. These were some of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
He would encounter little old ladies who bought into this and then frankly felt that they had been defrauded, or that if they were like the widow's mite, you know, in the Bible. So he came to experience that at a local level, village level, as kind of an abuse of people. And so for him it was like, well, yeah, I know my church teaches about the grace of God, but look at these particular practices. The practices seem to be at odds with the official theology. And so this is what then drives him to more study, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it drives him eventually to nail some propositions on the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral, which was, to many people, the de facto beginning of the Reformation. But it really wasn't, was it?
No, well, you know, and then a year later, about a year later, then the Pope... I think it's Leo X, I guess, he publishes this bull, Exsurge Domine, which responds and then attempts to refute about 30 or 40 of the 95.
Well, they're 95 theses. But what I read, and you tell me if this is wrong, that it was common practice in the 16th century Catholic university world to put up these theses for the sake of public disputation, even if you agreed with what you were putting up or not.
Right. It was like, you know what it was like? It was a community bulletin board. You put up the community bulletin board, you put it on the website, as it were. You know, really, it's true. You put it on the website. Next Tuesday, you know, here we are at this university or this academic institution. We're publicly announcing, and this was a medieval tradition, the following questions are going to be debated.
Right.
And the eminent scholar, Mary Smith and Joe Blow, are going to be here, and they're going to duke it out.
He even sent these theses to his archbishop.
Yeah.
I mean, he did it in obedience, and that's why I don't think we can really point to the 95 theses as the beginning of the Reformation. This could have gone a different direction, but it didn't.
But you have this volatile personality. I mean, it's as if the stars had aligned themselves at this point in history.
Right.
And then what, you know, then he burns the papal bull. And then the excommunication comes of the final bull.
Well, let's not skip over the distinguished scholastic philosopher and theologian Cajetan, the Jesuit.
Who
came to Augsburg, was sent to Augsburg by the Pope, and sat down face to face with Luther. Now, I would have loved to have been a fly on that wall.
That was at Worms, I think. And, yeah, and they did, I don't
think. Then the Catholic Encyclopedia got that one wrong.
That was the so-called famous Diet of Worms,
right.
Or as we joke about it in confirmation class, the Diet of Worms. Lutheran kids like to do that. Like, what are these guys eating worms for? But it's Cardinal Cajetan and Luther start duking it out at Worms because it's at Augsburg later. He appears before Charles V. And, well, he doesn't appear. At Augsburg, in fact, it's Melanchthon, his right-hand man, who appears because Luther and all the rest of the Lutherans, although they didn't call themselves at this point, realized that Luther was too volatile of a figure. They needed someone who was much more...
And his friend Melanchthon became that person.
Right, because the content of Melanchthon is virtually the same as Luther, but if you read them, they're nothing like each other from a standpoint. I mean, you read Melanchthon, and he almost sounds like Thomas Aquinas in terms of the literary style. So they send Melanchthon to Augsburg to explain what are these so-called Protestants doing. Well, that's 1535, though, I think. He sends them and appear before the emperor. They said, Luther says, I can't go because I know what's going to happen to me. I'm going to lose it. He says, I'm going to lose it. You need to go. I'm not a good representative at this point, but I trust the content of what you're saying. But, yeah, that comes later. But, yeah, before Cajetan, you have the famous Here I Stand speech and, you know, the right standing in the room, the cardinal demanding that he recant certain specific beliefs and writings. And then Luther's famous response of, unless you can show me by scriptural reference in the original languages how this is not the case, then, quote, here I stand.
Okay, well, let's leave it there, and we'll take a short break. Come back with Pastor John Berenson. Talk more about the remarkable, and as it's taught in the Catholic Encyclopedia, unfortunate career of this Augustinian monk, Martin Luther. Please come back for that conversation.
As Christians, we are taught that what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart. And in Ephesians, it reads, no bad word should come from your mouth, but only what is good and edifying, that it may give grace to those who hear. If you want to have a clean mouth without having to use soap, start by cleansing the heart. Think back to those various points in life when the anger that festered inside eventually percolated up and right out of your mouth with words of hate for people who have hurt you, offended you, lied to you, used you, abused you, stole from you, or perhaps altered your life forever. When we hold on to the past, we cloud the love of Jesus Christ, and what emerges is the pain inflicted on us from mankind. If you find yourself cursing, spewing hateful words about others, or often negative about life, then close your mouth and open your heart. Fill it with the love of our Lord, and let His words emerge from your mouth. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, the communication evangelist.
Christ the King Church began its new Catholic Worldview Education Series with a talk by former parishioner Father Michael Keating, the director of the Catholic Studies Program at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis.
Serious-minded Catholics have Catholic wills, that is, we're trying to do the right thing, and we've got pieces of the world that are very Catholic, but in terms of an overall integrated way of seeing the world, we often have not found a way into a genuinely Catholic mind, and I think this is one of the great tasks of our time. We might just note that in every age, the highest part of us, of course, is our mind. The Lord addresses Himself to the mind. We are in the image of God because we have a mind and a will.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Listen to Healing the Wounds of the Modern Mind on Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3. Encore Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEL, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
I'm back with Pastor John Berenson, a Lutheran minister for many years in the Philadelphia area, now retired. We're talking about the life, work, and influence of an Augustinian monk named Martin Luther. We've gotten to the point in the history where Luther has nailed his 95 theses onto the church door in Wittenberg. That was in 1517. Through his private meeting with the Jesuit Cardinal Cajetan, which did not go well, and into the public meeting they had in Worms later, where Martin Luther made his famous Here I Stand speech. John, what I want to ask you is, from what I've read, it was not Martin Luther's intention at the time to lead a revolt from the church. Is that correct?
Absolutely. He regarded himself and believed passionately that he was doing this for the sake of the church he loved. He regarded himself as, quote, a loyal son of the church. His actual hope, even privately, was that he could persuade, whether it was the Pope or some of the theologians, that there needed to be reform of various practices because they seemed to violate, the practices seemed to violate, especially penance, that was the thing that set it off, seemed to violate the theology of grace that the church preached. And so it really did break his heart. But I get this sense as it unfolds that both sides start to become more and more defensive. You know, it's almost a classic defensive thing like you even see in politics to this day. More and more defensive, more and more entrenched, not listening to one another, what one another is saying, talking past one another. Then
And the political leaders got into it.
Yes.
Got into the fray.
It's interesting. One of the questions that's always raised was, why did Martin Luther, quote, succeed? That is to say, why did the public breach take place and stick under Luther when it didn't, for instance, under people like John Huss, who was an Eastern European Czech theologian who was burned at the stake?
Or Wycliffe, or John Wycliffe.
Right, yes. Why do these people, or even the Savonarolas of the earlier times, how come those guys just became part of the dustbin of history? Well, now you're right. It's politics, because simultaneous with all this religious turmoil within the church that Luther's brewing up, is you get at the same time the emergence of the middle class in Europe, the merchant classes. Now many of the princes in Europe under Rome begin.
And they're a little tired of paying the Vatican. Right. What the Vatican
they're
demands.
They're also tired of taking orders about what they can do politically and appointments and that. So now some of the princes and dukes in Central Europe politically want to resist being part of the authority of Rome. They don't want to be pushed around anymore. So they say, here's this guy, Luther, who seems to be a burr in the saddle of the people we're trying to, you know, get some more freedom from in terms of more political operations. And they come to the aid of Luther. And, in fact, there was one key one, and I forget, you know.
Frederick.
Dukas, yeah, who come to his aid, literally. It's that which means that all of a sudden now, this has an infrastructure, and it sticks. So it's not just a John Huss protesting and getting burned at the stake, some lowly protester. Now there is political clout behind it. And that's what begins to open the doors to Europe actually changing from late Middle Ages and Renaissance into this new era, even politically. But yes, it's the partnership of Luther with the various German politicians that allow him to be protected and to continue his work.
You know, and eventually, of course, under the successive waves of reformers and successful reform movements and the creation of new Christian denominations, the Catholic Church itself would call a council 1 year before Martin Luther's death, and that is in 1545, the
right.
Council of Trent would start, which
right.
was an attempt to the church to reform itself along many of the bases that Luther and some other reformers had pointed out.
Right. Yes. It might not have happened had there not been all this turmoil. So in a sense, the two started to work together to create, in a sense, a certain kind of reforming and revolution within the church. I wanted to shift just for a moment and say we're talking about a large public things. You know, Luther privately was very much also not only a scholar but a pastor. And one of the things that's valuable that you're not going to hear too much in your tradition that we do is really Luther the pastor. Luther, the one who was interested in childhood education.
Well, you know, actually our Catholic scholars go in, you know, congratulate Luther as a pastor and congratulate him, for example, not leaving Wittenberg when the plague hit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You're supposed to stay put in, you know, you're not supposed to bail out. There was a number of writings on should you flee from a deadly plague or should you hang in there with the folks, you know. Very passionate writings about that. But early on, when the breach finally happened, he and some others took a tour of the provinces to assess the educational level of the priests, because they wanted to see, well, how are the troops doing here? And one of the things, they became appalled at what they felt was almost a complete lack of education of preachers and church officials. And this became a spark in terms of what's become in Lutheranism a strong emphasis on higher education and education. And to this day, you know, Lutheran young people go through 3 years of confirmation, years would be CCD. And but a lot of this is Luther, was a result of Luther, he felt everybody, the preachers and the people needed to be literally educated in secondary and higher education. And so he was very much a practical reformer as well. He also was someone who liked to console. He was very interested in what brings consolation to those who suffer.
You know, because that's what he wanted so badly.
Right, yeah. He felt he finally had experienced it.
How can a man who's so tortured and was tortured to the end of his life successfully bring consolation to others?
Well, I tell you what, an interesting source for this is the Table Talk. This is very accessible.
Martin Luther's Table Talk.
Table Talk, where people have come to his home over a period of years, 20, 30, 40 years, to he and Catherine's home, and they had this kind of weekly roundtable where they just sat around. Like, you could just walk into Luther's house, and Katie and Martin would serve up beer and food, and you'd sit around and tell stories. And that was, like, for years and years and years. Well, people took notes on this, and it's called the Table Talk. And you get a real sense of what was going on inside the home. You get the sense of the kind of personal advice and counsel he would give to people who had personal problems. There's a whole series of writings, spiritual writings, about people, what to do when you're depressed. I mean, almost like Dr. Phil type stuff.
What does he say, as a matter of fact, about what to do when you're depressed?
Well, it's a little bit, having been a person who suffered from depression, but myself.
Well who hasn't? So, go ahead.
Right. He basically says, the second part of it we wouldn't recommend nowadays. He basically say, you can't isolate yourself. He almost says, go out and have a party with friends and have a couple of drinks. He actually says that. But basically what he encourages his friends who are depressed to do is watch how much alone time you're having. You shouldn't be too isolated.
Interesting. That's what they say now.
Yeah.
About depression.
You need to go. You need to go against your tendency to isolate yourself. You need to get out there in the public, be with your friends. He said even have a little partying. And again, he would then emphasize that to trust that God's taking care of you, you know, that even your worst and most mumbling prayers are heard by God. So he's very much a pastor at this point.
Well, that's pretty good. I mean, I you know, you and I talked about our own bouts of depression. And when I've read about it at times when I needed to, one of the first things the modern psychologist said is don't let yourself become isolated.
Right, it's too easy to psychologize Luther, just like it was too easy to psychologize. In fact, there was a famous 1950s book by a famous Harvard psychiatrist. I'm forgetting who he was. It was a guy, the behaviorist guy. I forget what his name was, who wrote a psychological biography of Luther that's infamous among Lutherans. But
yeah.
You might want to go look it up. But the other thing that I most appreciated about the pastoral side of Luther, in fact, one of the sayings that I keep above my desk that comes from the Table Talk is, we are meant to be human beings, not divine.
His whole notion was that our earthiness is precisely the place where we encounter God. His theology of the cross means not so much about the crucifixion, but that you actually encounter
Eric Erickson, young man Luther.
Yeah. Yeah, Eric Erickson's a notorious book. Luther scholars trash it. But if you if you want to read a really notorious exposé of Luther's psyche and his father, go read Eric Erickson and then take a bath. But anyway,
well, we think that about most behaviorists these days, whatever they're talking about.
But anyway, Luther's, because of his emphasis on God's grace, that God has done it all in Jesus Christ with no remainder of anything for you to do. Therefore, quote, therefore, what are you now going to do to serve your neighbor? In other words, his disconnect from good works ends up with a reconnect. But the way it happens is now the good works that you do are just acts of gratitude. They had nothing to do with merit, demerit. It's just that you're so gosh darn grateful. Why wouldn't you go help your neighbor? So he kind of changes the whole logic and dialectic of ethics. But also what it means is you don't have to worry so much anymore about you. And so that's a very pastoral thing. I don't have to be so obsessed about John anymore. Of course, he was obsessed about it, so I don't have to worry about John so much anymore, and I have time to worry about you. And so it's a very pastoral and socially oriented sort of move.
Well, you know, we listened at the beginning of the program to the St. Olaf Choir. The coming into existence of that choir and the emphasis on beautiful choral singing, a cappella singing, is no accident either, is it?
Because, of course, another part of the story of those times, in the Reformation times, and it was even part of the Catholic Church, I think, too, with some of its great late medieval and Renaissance composers. But you get to Luther, and Luther loved palestry, et cetera. Luther now wants to revise not only the liturgy, it's very small revisions. In fact, our evangelical friends accuse us of not making enough revisions to the Mass. But the emphasis on singing and on hymnody is literally born with Luther. He's a musician as well.
He was a composer, right?
Right. There's about 10 original hymns that are still in our books that were written by him.
Was a Mighty Fortress?
Right, Mighty Fortress. And there's another four or five of them. And they've gone through a lot of, if you look at the originals, they're hard to sing because of the meter at the time. And so they've been kind of revised since the time of Bach. So they're a lot easier to sing.
But they're sort of woven into Bach's cantatas, correct?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and there's a strong emphasis in Martin Luther that music can do what our words alone can't do. He truly believed that they're a form of proclamation, that they're a secondary form of the proclamation of the good news of Jesus Christ. And so, for instance, he has a whole setting of the Nicene Creed that he writes, a hymn. Now, it's very awkward to sing, but he gets to the whole Nicene Creed
right
in music, and it's kind of fun to follow.
Well, the credo is always the hardest part of the Mass to set, I think.
It goes so long. So there's the emphasis in Protestantism, as you know, on congregational singing. And that was, you know, the complaint of my wife, who, as you know, was a former Roman Catholic. To this day, after 30 years of marriage, is why do we have to sing seven verses when we could sing one? Like when I was still a Catholic, I could sing one or maybe nothing. If the organist didn't show up, the same complaints. So I'll say, well, if I'm planning a liturgy, I'll say, okay, honey, I'll have you just sing three verses this week.
Well, you know, I wanted to go back to a little more contentious point. You know, we have the nailing of the 95 Theses in Wittenberg in 1517, but only 4 years later, in 1521. We have a number of Martin Luther's former friends, monks at the Augustinian monastery, refusing to say private Mass anymore and getting married. And I would say that that's the moment where I would say the Reformation started, when you had you know?
And a guy, they would defend it, of course, by they would go back to scriptural texts in a way that hadn't been done before.
And they took off their habits.
Yeah.
They then started omitting part of the Mass that they didn't think was necessary and so forth.
Well, not necessary. They felt the parts that they wanted to omit, they felt misled the public about God's love and grace. And so they would go through with a very careful pruning hook and say, anything that's in there that would lead me as a parishioner to believe that there's something I could do for my salvation on the front end.
Well, as you well know, I mean, the Catholic dissenters to this day, including priests who want to get married and so forth, they do exactly the same stuff.
What do you
as was done in October 1521. So, I mean, this is being reenacted, and especially in Europe right now, among some of the dissenting German and Austrian clergy. The question I have for you is, Martin Luther eventually got married, but much later, correct?
Well, you know what? It wasn't that later. I mean, he and Catherine, I mean, I think that starts, well, it starts after he's been expelled.
Excommunicated.
It starts after that. But, you know, as far as he's concerned, he looks at the scriptures and he said, look, in ancient times, you have all these people that were married, and there were married bishops and this, so he knew that it was more a tradition of monasticism of the 4th century, and that it was not doctrinal, it was more a matter of practice. So
And we still see priestly celibacy as a matter of discipline and practice.
Right. And I mean, most of my Protestant friends don't know that. And in fact, most of my Catholic lay friends don't know that. My mother-in-law, who is a very observant Catholic and very up on things, she did not know that not being married was really more of an option of practice and not a matter of dogma. She didn't know that. You know, the male-female thing is different. I mean, I knew that. But as far as married versus unmarried, so I guess if we're around for another 100 years, you're going to see some of those changes.
Oh, I would dispute that, but we'll leave that for another debate. But, of course, anything's possible, but I think that one will stick.
No, I don't mean male-female. I meant married priests.
Yeah, I know. That's what I knew you were talking about. But
okay.
Let's go on to Luther's own marriage. I know in some of the more virilous attacks on Luther, his marriage was particularly targeted for his marriage.
Well, I don't know what those are. I mean,
The fact that she was an ex-nun, for example.
Right. And her name was Catherine von Bora. But I know that he felt that even from a purely theological standpoint, they were unbound by, so I'm not sure what the scandal, I guess I can understand.
By the way, the Catholic scholars in the 1917 encyclopedia say that the marriage was a happy one.
Oh, yes. Yeah. In fact, one of the wonderful books about, it's called Women of the Reformation by Roland Bacon, the famous biographer from the 1950s of Martin Luther.
And that's a biography you basically recommend to anyone who wants to study.
Yeah, we talked about that before we began. It was written in the 1950s, but it's beautifully and simply written and so accurate to this day. Roland Bacon was a scholar at Yale University. He was the preeminent Reformation historian from the 1950s.
And he was one of your teachers.
Yes, yeah. Well, he was in retirement, but we used to have dinner with him. And he was this little, almost Yoda the Jedi master sort of guy. And he appreciated cultural things. He spoke about 12 languages. But his biography called Here I Stand is what popularized that phrase, Here I Stand. But it's still good reading, and it's very accessible to anyone. What it captures is the experience of Luther. That is to say, beyond what you and I are talking about, what this guy was really going on in his head, and what really drove him, as well as how that interacted with the times he was in. So the Bacon thing is still wonderful, as old as it is. I mean, it's 50, 60 years old. It's still wonderful. But he also then, in his retirement, Roland Baton wrote two volumes of, quote, Women of the Reformation. Now, you can imagine the first volume had one about Catherine, but other unknown women who were behind the scenes. I don't know if they're still in print, but they were very...
Well, by the way, to answer the question, it was 4 years after these Augustinian monks married en masse. It was 4 years later, in 1525, that Catherine and Martin Luther became married. And they had six children, not five. I was mistaken about that earlier.
Yes, and she was apparently a very strong figure, a very kind of, I think, positive influence, kind of a manager, a household manager, who was very, very assertive in a good sense, ran the household, had her own little brewery, and that's why a lot of people like to come to the house, because, you know, basically it was a destination. The place was a destination for prominent people.
You know, I guess probably the question that listeners want me to ask you now with 5 minutes left in our interview, that I understand that Luther came to regret in his last years in the 1540s what had happened with his effort to reform, that he saw a lot of negative consequences flow from that.
Yes. And, you know, I'm not the one to answer that, because at this point I'd have to point you to people like Timothy Ringer at the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, who's kind of the world's leading Reformation historian. I'm not sure I can speak to that. I know toward the end he had a lot of regrets that the word Lutheran was being bandied about. That much I knew. When he was very ill toward the end, he said, I so much regret this whole, quote, Lutheran thing. Luther is nothing, and I don't like it, but I guess we're forced to live with it. That much I do know about him. And his last reported words before dying, as recorded in the temple talk, at the table talk, is, we are all beggars. It is true. So he regarded the life of the baptized. In fact, one of his famous sayings was, what does the true worship of God consist in? Now, this is a kind of a reflection on the Mass. What does the true worship of God consist in? He said to this person who asked, it's one beggar showing another beggar where to find a scrap of food.
Well, that spiritually is a very powerful, extremely powerful thought, one that's echoed by Catholic spiritual writers, in the entire history of the Church.
One of the things I often sometimes say in sermons, if it lends itself to that, if the sermon is headed in that direction, just before the sermon concludes, and we're going to head toward the meal now, the Lord's Supper, I'll say, one of the most astonishing and shocking things about coming forward to receive bread and wine is that every one of us in this room is coming with empty hands. And, whether you're a disabled person, whether you're a person of means, whether you're a person of education, whether you're troubled, whether you're bankrupt, every single one of us comes with empty hands now. And I find myself saying that more and more as a pastor. I think that's Lutheran, but I think that's just centrally Christian.
Oh, I think so. And I don't think there's any real difference between a Lutheran and a Catholic saying that. I mean, they mean the same thing, do they not? They might think of the remedy as different.
Yeah.
But the state is the same, is it not?
Yeah, and one of my hopes and prayers, of course it's influenced personally, but even from my teachers, is that if we come back in 1,000 years or 500 years, I don't know, some things are going to be different deal. I have to believe it. If I wasn't a Lutheran, I like to joke, if I weren't a Lutheran, I'd either be a Presbyterian or a Catholic. Don't ask me to go into that. But
no, next time.
There are options. It's my only two other options.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's stop here, and I want to thank you, Pastor John Berenson, for being my guest on Church and Culture, and hope you'll come back. And let's listen to a little more of St. Olaf Choir singing on the way out.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you.
listening to the great St. Olaf Choir sing a Christmas song written by its founder and longtime choral director, and we've been talking to a graduate of St. Olaf College and a member of that great choir, Pastor John Berenson. And once again, I want to say, John, thanks a lot for being my guest on Church and Culture.
You are welcome, brother.
And to all of you who are listening, please join me at this time and this place next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make sense in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
Attention high school juniors and seniors. You're invited to Winterfest 2014 presented by Ave Maria University. Come learn about the Ave Maria University Southeast Michigan Diocesan Scholarship of $28,000 over 4 years. Join us Saturday, December 6th from 6 to 9:30 p.m. at the Rink and Recreational Building for ice skating, dinner, giveaways, and a performance by national figure skater Victoria Craw. Registration is required by November 30th, and space is limited. Register now at AveMariaFoundation.org.
Did you know that Santa's helpers go to school to learn how to be super and spiritual Santas? Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Join me on Power from the Pews to hear Father Joseph Marquis tell us about the St. Nicholas Institute. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by our day sponsor. To celebrate the feast day of St. Cecilia, patroness of musicians, and in memory of Aziz Dabish, from his granddaughter Heather. Also for all expectant mothers, just like Heather, who's expecting a baby girl in February. If you want to be a day sponsor and or want to say a message for a loved one or friend, call 877-288-1077. Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
Sunday is the feast of Christ the King. Well, what does it mean? Well, first of all, that Christ is in charge. Jesus is king over the whole universe. Now, what does his kingly power consist? Jesus' power is not that of the kings and leaders of this world. It's the divine power to give eternal life, set people free from evil, and to defeat the dominion of death. It's the power of love, which knows how to soften hardened hearts, to bring peace even to the harshest conflict. It's the power to kindle hope in the murkiest darkness, to bring the highest good out of the darkest evil. You know all that, but it's good to be reminded of it, and that's what today's feast does. God's kingdom of grace never